of the U.S. Center for World Mission. He still carries on a full-time program there of teaching and administration and writing, and has had an impact in today's world of missions. We've asked him to give a bio of his life, his path that the Lord has led him on. Now, that's quite a challenge for a person that's had as full and crammed a life as Ralph, and I think he's going to be selective. One time at a meeting, someone described Ralph as one whose thinking is outside the box. One of his two brothers responded and says, "With Ralph, there is no box." So here's a very creative thinker, and I can't even predict what he's going to tell us about, but I know before I get him started, he's not going to be able to cover everything. He and his two brothers grew up in Lake Avenue Church. During World War II, he was in the Navy, and in the V-12 training program was assigned to Caltech. And while he was taking his coursework at Caltech, he learned that they were going to be transferred out after a year. And he still had 2 years to go. So he got busy and doubled up all his courses and finished 2 years at Caltech and got his degree there. He subsequently has studied at such places as Princeton, Cornell, Columbia, Prairie Bible Institute, to name just a few. Not sure how many degrees he has, but anyway, we're privileged to have you with us, Ralph, and thank you so much for making the effort to be here. And Barbara, thank you for being his chauffeur and coming today. After the Lord called Roberta home a while back, the Lord brought brought Barbara into his life. So thanks, Barbara. So Ralph, it's all yours.
If you're going to have cancer, the best kind to get is the kind that took my wife 2 years ago, which I've now gotten. It's slow, but it's sure, but it takes 2 or 3 years, and it may be that it'll be a little longer because of a clinical trial I got into very fortunately in July. Unfortunately, in addition to this invisible cancer, which I have no sensation of at all, it's just lab tests, you can tell, I have two or three other problems which have kept me awake at night, most of the night, for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And then I'm also taking some chemotherapy, which makes me giddy and talkative. And then yesterday afternoon, for the first time in weeks, I got this remission from pain. And it lasted all night long, so you think I get a good night's sleep, but I have this chemotherapy which kept me bright and wide awake all night long. I got in about an hour and a half in the morning. So anyway, that's where I happen to be. Kind of lucky that I'm even able to come here. Meanwhile, I was using up the last of my wartime GI Bill tuition to acquire a PhD in linguistics in order to go to Afghanistan myself. By this time, I was married and we were both eager to do this, even though it did not quite work out. I accepted Christ in Christian Endeavor Conference held in the Long Beach Civic Auditorium. Bob Munger, a young pastor at that time, led the decision service. Some of you know Bob Munger, who died shortly a while ago. Later, when I was 15, my parents felt they had to move from a Presbyterian church that had given up Christian Endeavor to a church that stressed it. Little did they know that Lake would soon hire a full-time youth pastor who has to stand up in front of the young people instead of the young people leading the meeting, and so Christian Endeavor was phased out at Lake too. In any case, we moved to Lake Avenue, where my father soon became a trustee and opposed going into debt for the removal of the corner church and the building of the present chapel. This is kind of a little detour here. He was not against doing it, he was just against going into debt for it. But at that moment, in Lake Avenue history, the church moved from where 50% of the budget had always gone to missions down to 33% for missions. Then when the current sanctuary was built again with even more massive debt, our mission budget declined to 18% and is now even lower. So much for the detour. A major factor in my life began at Lake Avenue, where I first encountered Dawson Trotman and Charles Fuller. My life was turned around into a much more intense commitment, mainly due to memorizing 500 verses in the Bible, continuing after enlistment in the Navy. Back in those days, Lake Avenue was in a rather hazy relation to any denomination, And so after teaching and studying at Westmont on top of Caltech degree during the war, and studying both at Princeton and Fuller, getting my PhD at Cornell, combining cultural anthropology, linguistics, and mathematical statistics, my wife and I went back to Princeton Seminary to finish up and be ordained as a Presbyterian missionary. Some years before, I had started at Princeton, along with Dan Fuller and Bill Bright, and all three of us then transferred to Fuller, where that seminary opened the following year. Neither Bill Bright nor I finished at Fuller. We thought we had more pressing things to do. He started Campus Crusade, and no one ever heard of him again. On the other hand, I felt led to a full-time missionary career rather than a tent maker, and so in preparation for that calling, I was engineering a radically new method of learning foreign languages and doing a PhD in linguistics to support that idea. I thought it would benefit all missionaries, and unlike Bill, I soon became famous. No, I think I got that back. Nevertheless, Bill and I formed a friendship which lasted until the day he died. He and Vonette invited me and my new wife to lunch just a few months before his death. Back in the days I was finishing up at Princeton, there was still some conservative evangelical Presbyterian fields, and Roberta and I and our then two children were recruited for one of the evangelical fields in the Western Highlands of Guatemala to work with a Mayan Indian tribe called the MAM, M-A-M. Work had been going on there for many years, even Bible translation. This is, in fact, precisely the place where Cameron Townsend, on his Bible co-porter activities as a young man who didn't finish college at Occidental, encountered these missionaries, and they persuaded him that it was of little value to distribute Bible portions in Spanish to people whose mother tongue was radically different. While in Guatemala those 10 years, I became involved in a plan reaching out to real local church leaders, for the first time including Indians. Now, these were laymen. Most of 200 churches were run by laymen. We reasoned that they could be taught and ordained without going off to the capital city for years to, quote, seminary. This plan of finding leaders rather than students and fitting into their lifestyles rather than extracting them into a school in a different culture caught on with our people and with other missions in Guatemala and in other countries. And soon I was invited to be the executive director of the Theological Education Association that covered the 17 Latin American countries north of the equator. The last gringo. From that point on, it's all Latin Americans who ran it. A year later, the new School of World Mission at Fuller, founded a year before, wanted another professor, and they were so impressed by this training system that I was invited to join the faculty, the first faculty member added after the founding. I was then instrumental in the calling of all of the additional professors and deans during the next 10 years. Not long after joining the faculty at Fuller, this new theological education idea became a movement. Its growth was due in part to global junkets by myself and others promoting the idea, sponsored by the Evangelical Foreign Missions Association. Soon it had encompassed 500 mission programs around the world and 100,000 local leaders who were training for ordination. Thus, the movement was running by itself, and although I was called to Fuller to promote this new idea, I only continued to teach one course in that area and soon transitioned into a first love, with a teaching focus on the historical growth factors of the Christian movement in the last 2,000 years as my main teaching duty. This was immeasurably enlightening. I discovered that a great deal that I had been taught at seminary about theological developments and Christian history, both at Fuller and Princeton, was not quite the whole story, or perhaps dead wrong, but that's another story. A recent book entitled For the Glory of God, published by Princeton University Press, no less, written by a sociologist, Rodney Stark, does the same thing. It is a devastating critique of historians and sociologists in general, and Christian historians and theologians in particular. A fabulous 80 pages, for example, are devoted to the rise of science under Christian influence. He doesn't feel there's any real science outside of the Christian tradition. I have written for permission to print that chapter as a separate book with our publishing imprint, which is the William Carey International University Press. Christian students and non-Christian students at Caltech will be flabbergasted. So much for the detour. Even more important, at Fuller, those 10 years, I had 1,000 missionaries go through my classes, write master's and doctoral theses about their field work. For me, this was a glorious introduction into the global phenomenon of Christianity. that led to some disturbing conclusions. I began to write and promote insight into the idea that thousands of minority groups around the world in mission lands were walled off from missions by the tendency of many missions to assume that the churches they planted, usually within one of the larger groups, could easily bridge the many ethnic differences which make most countries into a linguistic mosaic. For example, there are 400 languages in Nigeria. Realizing that this was an overlooked dimension that affected strategies in virtually all fields, it became impressive that something must be done. Someone would have to stop teaching and begin actively promoting outreach to these additional totally pioneer fields that were invisible to America, to American melting pot assumptions by missionaries from this country and also from Europe. The entire faculty at Fuller discussed for a while. I don't know that he would have dared to write this book had he not been retired already. He's living in New Mexico for the last 4 years. He's just now accepted a position at Baylor University. His name is Rodney Stark, S-T-A-R-K. And the name of the book is For the Glory of God. The dust jacket says, this remarkable statement says, this man believes firmly that all the virtues of modern civilization have been produced by people who sought the glory of God. It's just an absolutely absurd statement in the secular world, written by a secular scholar in a secular context, produced by Princeton University Press. And I have a strong feeling there must be some evangelicals at the top at Princeton University Press, because they printed two of his earlier books, which are also about Christianity and are very mind-blowing. But this book is probably the best of all. It has four parts. The first part has to do with the history of Christianity. And he starts out by saying, look, I'm not a Catholic. I never have been a Catholic. But he said, in the secular world, it's surprising how biased people are against the Catholic Church. Now, I have never in my life thought about defending the Catholic Church, but you know, it's like Germany, where Hitler outlawed the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Lutherans said, well, that's okay. And then they outlawed the Seventh-day Adventists, and the Lutherans said, okay. And finally, they came around to the Lutherans, and they said, oh, we should have objected earlier. I think probably Protestants ought to lean over backwards in trying to see the Catholic Church in its true light, its warts as well as its virtues. And this book is very fair, and it's constantly pointing out biases and flaws in the field of history, secular scholars as well as religious scholars. That first section. And the second section has to do with heresies and divergent movements that have often been underrated or misunderstood. And he doesn't necessarily uphold them. He just describes them more accurately than it is usually done. The third section is this section on saints. I've always wondered about this because, you know, they talk about Greek science and Roman science and so forth. And you know, science is a kind of a loose term in some ways. But he says true science, which is based upon faith in an orderly creation, really hasn't sprung up any place else but in the Christian tradition. He just takes credit for all of science, practically, in that statement. And it's a very fascinating chapter. The last chapter has to do with slavery, down through history, and the Christian involvement with slavery, and the fact that Christianity eventually got out of that background and quelled it in many other nations, of course. Today, there are more slaves than there ever been in history, in actual number, maybe not in percentage, but today there are 27 million people in slavery, even in this country. I was reading the other day that you can drive down a certain road in Florida, and there are these big, beautiful mansions on this side of the road. On that side of the road, there's a fence, and there's some sort of plantation there. And there are people on that plantation who are absolutely enslaved. They can't get out. They're illegal immigrants. They have no basis of claiming anything about anything. And there are hundreds of people, actually thousands of people like that in the United States, in absolute slavery. Now, maybe we don't beat them up and kill them like they used to do, but even that probably didn't always happen. It's just one of those crazy things that somehow slavery, there's probably 1,000 young women that are spirited out of Central Europe every month into prostitution. It's just absolute slavery all over the world. Yeah.
While I still have the mic, I joined this Frontier Fellowship 23 years ago, and I joined with the idea of what kind of a, could I make some helpful contribution? The thing is so good, can I make a contribution? I had no concept at all of what kind of an awesome learning experience it would be in this nerve center for missions for the last 23 years. But I should give you a little illustration of the type of challenge we sometimes got in the early years. One day, Dr. Winter says to me, now look, for $10,300, we can get a new telephone system for the whole campus. Would you go to work to raise the money? And I said, well, all right, how much time? He said, by 5:30 this afternoon. I was successful. You know, we had to be successful in those early days.
By 5:30?
I was really touched when you talked about Lake Avenue. I've been in Lake Avenue for 40 years, and it's sad to see, like you're talking about, the missions are less now than even 18%. And I'm sitting here trying to figure out why are we sort of upside down, and how would I ask this question to him? What's going wrong? And then I thought, well, maybe I could ask a question by saying, what is the test of a great church? Or how would I ask you a question from your perspective? What's the test of a great church? What, maybe that would be the way to ask the question. In other words, why are we where we are, you think, from your perspective, being a man of missions?
Well, you know, I
don't pull any punches if you don't. I mean, I don't mind you telling me the truth.
I'm very loyal to Lake Avenue. I would say the question is not whether Lake Avenue is a great or greater or lesser church. It's a different church. There was a time when most of the people in the church really believed in missions. That's no longer true. And if the church is going to be true to its members, you know, it's market-driven, it's going to have to change percentages. You couldn't get away with 50% today because, you know, there'd be all kinds of screams and hollers, and people would say, you're using my money in ways I don't intend. You have to listen to the donor. And I think Lake Avenue is a truly great church, even today. But it's a different church. It's reaching some people who are different, better than ever before. And I don't think it's a bad church in any way. I don't think it's gotten worse or anything else. It's just gotten different. It's nice, of course, when you come across a church that gives 50% of its budget to missions. But you don't find churches like that unless you have a vast, extensive knowledge of missions in the church. And Lake Avenue grew up as a missionary church. And that explains why they were giving 50% years ago.
You're speaking of international missions.
Yeah.
Whereas now, as a newcomer, I see an awful lot being done to reach the local community. And this connection with the public schools, I think, is fantastic, having been a public educator myself, to have that inroad. And I'm sure there are dollars from the budget going to that. Now, whether that's being counted as part of the mission budget, I don't know, but it's a local mission, certainly.
Nobody asked me where I got my second wife. Almost 2 years ago, my first wife died. I scoured the whole country, and I finally found a woman in St. Louis that was just right.
Ralph, many of us have stood by and watched with amazement how God has used you. And when I first came back to and went to Lake Avenue in 1947, why the name Ralph Winter was on many, many lips, and many of us came to admire how God was using him. I don't know how to ask this question exactly, but or if the Lord does not return, how do you see the center 20 years from now? If that's not a fair question, you don't have to answer.
Well, I am very rapidly coming to the end of my days, so I'm not thinking that far ahead. I'm thinking about the next 2 years. And we still have major problems to solve, and we're working at them. And I'll tell you, one of the most rewarding, probably the most rewarding thing in my whole life is to have helped create a community of families that live all in the same place, have their hearts in the same place, and work together like a large family. Roberta got sick about 7 years ago. I was completely out of it for a month. She was in the hospital, and and I couldn't do a thing. Things ran without skipping a beat. And that was 7 years ago. In fact, in 1990, I turned over the leadership of the U.S. Center for World Mission to a younger man, Greg Parsons. And so that's running like a top. I was briefly president of the university, and then we got another man who was a very outstanding. We got a man who was too outstanding. He was president for 4 years, but then he was so outstanding that the International Mission Board of the Southern Baptists turned him away. He was basically Southern Baptist. And you know, Southern Baptists, some of them are Southern Baptist first, Christian second, you know. So I don't blame him for going out to the International Mission Board. And but he's still on our board of directors, and Ben Sells is his name. He's a wonderful guy. So then we had to start looking for another president. And I was put in as interim president, which is what I am. But even now, most of the things in the university run without my help at all. And I go to the hospital twice a week, and that I don't have to worry about anything. You know, it's really a rewarding experience, being an engineer background, to see something run without your pushing it. Lots of people build things that need their help forever. But for an engineer, if it doesn't run without your help, you haven't succeeded. And in this case, I think it's a very gratifying success that I have a permanent community that's going to last. Who knows? I mean, some of these types of groups like this, see, for example, the mission boards, like the IFMA mission boards, like the Overseas Missionary Fellowship, they were founded in 1865. They're just as true today as they ever were. But there's no congregation, no church congregation that has lasted more than five generations. They all go downhill. And so this is a much more permanent and durable structure than a church denomination would be, or a church, local church would be. And so I'm very, very happy about the results. I you know, someone said to me the other day, oh, this is not your time. You're going to have to live longer. And I said, look, as far as I'm concerned, I could die tomorrow. I'd be very, very happy. I've done lots of exciting things. It's been a tremendously rewarding life. I don't have anything I have to do yet, you know. So it's really quite amazing. But I am fully occupied. I work a 10-hour day and committees and meetings of all kinds. And in most cases, I'm a spectator. I don't make decisions. But at least it's a rewarding relationship.
A few years ago, I started becoming interested in what's going on in American Native Christians. In fact, it was 99 when I got wind of a seminar at the U.S. Center for World Mission, led by several American Native Christians, and had a powwow on Saturday. And there were three books that I ultimately got. One of them started out by Richard Twist to be 500 Years of Bad Haircuts, which he had to change the title of to One Church or Many Tribes to be printed by a legitimate publisher.
Thank you.
Another one was Living in Color, which was by a part Cherokee fellow, Randy Woodley. And then a third one was White Man's Gospel by a fellow from Chippewa who lives in Arizona now. I know at least one of these books you've read, because I think I saw some words you wrote about the book on the cover or something like that. What is your feeling about what's going on now in the realm of American Native Christianity and the relationship between with the dominant church?
Well, I must say the casino phenomenon has radically changed that whole situation. It's sort of like the Middle East. Their oil money has just radically changed their situation. So it is a little different today, but the rule of thumb in missiology, in the study of missions, is that no minority will ever be treated right in their own country, because the people in that same country have vested interests that interfere with the minority's concerns. So in a certain sense, until we get Swedish missionaries to American Native peoples, they don't even trust Americans. They would trust Swedish missionaries, but not Americans. The other thing is that people in this country, they get along fine with national churches that are in Africa doing strange things, or in India doing strange things. But they won't let any of the Indians do strange things. for this country. So the idea of what they call contextualization is almost impeded significantly by the outreach in this country. For example, I have been with Presbyterian missionaries in Mexico, working with Mexican Indians. I've been with Presbyterian missionaries in the United States, working with American Native peoples. The radical difference is just appalling. The perspective about how to do the work, what would be the result, or what would be a success, or how you go about it. I was up in Tacoma one time, and there's a little tribe of Indians there, and there was a faithful worker. He and his wife had been working for 27 years or something with that tribe. They were telling me about how they had established a little service center for Native Americans coming into town, in the middle of the town, and they had a man, they had an Indian running it. But pretty soon he wanted to take over, he wanted to run things by himself, and so we had to get rid of him. So, well now, in overseas mission, you don't just get rid of people, they get rid of you. You're not a citizen, you're in a lesser position, you don't have the power, much less the wisdom to try to get rid of leaders. But somehow there is no future whatsoever for outreach to American Indians unless foreign mission perspectives and strategies are employed. And thus far they have not been extensively, except in the Navajo area.
Or how about unless they do it themselves?
Well, of course, that's the whole idea. You don't expect to do things for them in foreign missions. You expect to do things for them in this country, maybe, but you try to believe that money will solve the problem, which is another thing. Foreign missions don't have any money, so they aren't tempted to pay pastors' salary. In this country, I remember coming up to a General Assembly at Portland one time, and I was talking to the associate director of our mission board in New York, and we were talking about the Native American churches in this country and the Spanish churches. He said, well, he says, 20 years ago, we started out with 135 churches, and we poured $850,000 a year into that work, and we